Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. This is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. It's been years in the making, and the city of La Crosse is a step closer to developing on the former mobile oil site near downtown. The city is now looking for public input on what will become the Riverside North Redevelopment Project. Here today to talk about the efforts are La Crosse City Planner Larry Kirch and Ed Pritarski, Chair of the Redevelopment Authority. Larry, I'm wondering if you can just first give us a brief history of the mobile oil site for those who aren't familiar with it.
Sure. This area, when you look at what's there today, was really kind of it's the confluence of the La Crosse River, the Black River, and the Mississippi River. This area was this huge wetland complex. In 1938, the city owned all this land, and we sold it to the Wadhams Oil Company if they would fill the wetlands, which they did, which no one really could do today. So between 1938 and really 1993, I guess, is when they had the Exxon Valdez go aground in Alaska. That created the Oil Protection Act that really stopped barges from coming up the river. And it was really around that time in 94, 95 that the tanks came down and the city started getting interested in redevelopment. What's going to happen to that 25 acres? So that's the Reader's Digest version of how we used to own it. And it really then took us, the last, 15, almost 20 years to acquire the property from Mobil, which then became ExxonMobil, and also the Petros family. So this is not just the Mobil site. It also included 11 acres of waterfront that was owned by the Petros family.
And it really was quite a process getting all this land acquired.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that the tank farm was going to go away, and then the city made overtures with Mobil, and then they got acquired by Exxon, and then we went through condemnation commission to acquire the property. And then way before I started with the city, there were overtures to the Petroses because the city bought a railroad corridor through the middle of their property back in the early 1980s. A lot of the tracks have been removed, but those tracks used to go from Causeway Boulevard on the north all the way through Riverside Park, all the way to Cass and Cameron Avenue. So the city acquired all that railroad right away in that entire corridor, and then lo and behold, we have a 100-foot, and then it narrowed down to 40 feet, and on both sides, the Petros family had property. So the city started, a long time ago talking to them, and then spent a long time trying to acquire it, and then eventually the city did buy it from them.
And then now it's in the process of being cleaned up because obviously the land was contaminated.
Well, at some point, Ed, I'll let you do
yes.
some talking here.
That's
but,
right.
Mobil had spent over $1 million of what are called PECFA, Petroleum Cleanup Fund monies. So they spent really almost two decades cleaning up the property. They did a big dig, I think, in 2011 and then again in 2012. After the city acquired the property from the Petros family, we got a DNR grant. Costs roughly $400,000 to clean up that site. It was basically a recycling yard, so there's contamination associated with that. So it's all clean. The remediation is done now.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about Riverside North Redevelopment Project, also known as the former Mobil Oil site in La Crosse. My guests are La Crosse City Planner Larry Kirch and Ed Pritarski. He's chair of the Redevelopment Authority. So this area, it's about 65 acres. There's some riverfront property there, and you all are hoping to develop upon it.
That's correct. And what we're looking at is what's going to be the best use for this property because it is a golden jewel. And listening to the SEH people that are running the charrette and that.
And can you explain SEH?
That's Short Elliott Hendrickson. We have a consultant team that's really three or four different firms that are participating along with the Redevelopment Authority and city staff to kind of guide the whole redevelopment visioning process.
That's correct. And we're looking at this as a possibility of a development that we looked at. We didn't want it to be piecemealed in. We wanted to look at the whole parcel and what would fit the best for all 69 acres. And it's going to have mixed use. We feel that there's, over 29 acres is in green space?
Yeah, there's floodway that really can't be developed. There's a huge wetland there, obviously the La Crosse River, and that a lot of the waterfront along what was the Petros property is really undevelopable because it's either wetland or floodway. So when you total up all that acreage, There's really, you know, maybe 30 to 35 acres that are developable.
There are people out there who say, why not leave the area natural? There still will be some natural area for people to enjoy down by the riverfront there.
Yeah, that's correct. Actually, there's a pond in there that's called Zilke Pond.
Supposedly that was the name, but so Pat Zilke will always have a hand in the city here. But my understanding was when the fish lab was at Riverside Park, there was a big fish rearing pond there. That got filled in, which is now where CenturyTel is. And in order to fill that in, the city had to put a permanent deed restriction on this 15-acre pond. And for whatever reason, it's been referred to as Zilke Pond. But that's really part of the La Crosse River floodway and really can't be developed. It is a great resting area for migratory birds. And then there's also a state-threatened bird that has been found on the site. So we have to really, we want to see redevelopment, but I think one of the goals that's been set out for this process is to have really this notion, and it's called design with nature. This kind of a landscape architect planner named Ian McCarg came up with this notion of let's design with nature, let's not always fight nature. So the idea that, you know, Mother Nature, what didn't get filled in, still is there, and so we should work around that.
And Ed, as you were saying, mixed use, hopefully.
Yes, and one of the things I do want to say, with the river, we want to make sure that there's public access with the river all the way through, and we want this to also to be the extension of our parkways, basically. Or no, I shouldn't say parkways, but our, what am I struggling here for?
System.
The trail system, thank you. But anyhow, that's a major goal, and I really believe that should be left for the public. And, you know, that's just my opinion, though, and that's why we're going through the charrette. But one of the things I see, it's basically the voyage going down the river, and it's a very good site that I believe that we could utilize for the public. And I also believe that there can be use for the river with maybe a marina area. You know, that's why I'm talking about different types of items that can be mixed use there. I believe that it's going to be should be used for housing. I think that there could be a big draw for some housing in there, especially 55 and over, seeing that I'm in that category now.
The I guess part of that site, again, it's unique in that it is at the confluence of our three rivers. And that waterfront that Ed's referring to, you know, we're on our overall city comprehensive plan, you know, and again, it would take a long time for us to get there just because of the historical use of the river. But right now we have built a bike trail at Isle of Plume, really connecting Gunderson Lutheran Medical Center. Now we're going to apply for a grant to really extend a trail all the way to West Avenue and South Avenue through what's called the VIP Trail around the Green Island Ice Arena, north along Isle of Plume, and then it'll be a street connection until you get to King Street, and that's the Riverwalk. Then once you get to the Riverwalk, you can get to the north end of Riverside Park. There's already a railroad bridge that takes you into this site. So we do have a DNR grant to start building a trail that it's going to loop around over to Copeland Avenue.
Huh.
So that trail is already being partially constructed. So there are things from a, I think from an amenity standpoint, that are already happening. Again, the waterfront is a huge amenity, but that trail, and people can, you know, today go use, it's not paved yet, but that trail's already under construction.
And also when we were talking about with this being mixed use, one of the things that we wanted to do is that we want to make sure that it's similar to what's to the east of this with the into the festival area, that it accents that. And we also I'm a believer that we don't want it to compete with what the downtown business is. What we wanted to do is enhance it. So I think that that's what our main draw is for this. Again, that goes through the whole charrette process.
Yeah, what you see across the street where Festival Foods is that Ed was referring to is you have a mixed-use development that has office, it has residential, it has commercial retail. And so I think maybe this site lends itself fairly well for residential because right across the street then you have grocery shopping and you have, you know needs that can be met along that corridor, whether it's transit or something like that. So I think, again, we've set out some either you know, we drafted them as staff, but working with the steering committee to what are some of the five or six or seven really kind of guiding principles of this development? One, of course, is that it, you know, complements downtown instead of competes with downtown.
And I liked how you talked about the design element of it, make sure that it complements the river. And I think about the Weber Center for the Performing Arts and how that was almost built with that in mind, too.
Yeah, I mean, that really is, you know, it has two fronts to that building. And so it has a front along, obviously, the Mississippi River and their big curtain wall and all that. And then, of course, as it presents itself to Front Street. So certainly there's some parallels that could be drawn there.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about the Riverside North Redevelopment Project, also known as the former Mobil Oil site in La Crosse. My guests are La Crosse City Planner Larry Kirch and Ed Pritarski. He's chair of the Redevelopment Authority. So let's talk about this public input process that's involved in this project. I guess just first and foremost, you're having some listening sessions this month, March 27th, and next month in April, regarding the upcoming public input process, if I'm not mistaken. Can one of you talk about just what's going on this month when it comes to public input for the project? Larry?
Sure. Well, actually, it started in February. We wanted three kind of get people loosened up, if you will, for the charrette process. So the first one was kind of an overview of the site and kind of a charrette 101. What is a charrette?
And what is a charrette?
A charrette is an intensive week-long planning process that we're really condensing what might happen over 8 months. Not that we're not been working on it for 8 months, but what the public will see will be 7 or 8 days of an intense workshop that offers essentially the same level of public input. A lot of projects you'll see like a kickoff meeting, and then you don't hear from anybody for 3 or 4 months, and then there'll be another meeting, and then 3 or 4 months later there'll be, here's the plan. What the charrette process does is condenses all that, so there's these internal feedback loops. We'll have those same types of meetings, but that will all happen in 7 days.
And that involves the public too?
They all involve the public, okay. Yeah. There'll be several public meetings along there. So in March 27th at 7 o'clock at Western Technical College in the Student Center is a kind of an overview of waterfronts. So we have on the team is Ed Freer from JJR out of Madison, and JJR, this company has worked all over the world. Ed will give us a slideshow and talk about urban renewal, urban revitalization, and how other cities have addressed their waterfront. April will be more of kind of an Earth Week theme because it's going to be April 24th, I want to say. And we're going to talk about, you know, there's some, again, the Bells Vireo, the wetlands, the floodway, if there is going to be any type of marina. And, again, that's yet to be seen. But then there are, you know, endangered mussel species, as we know, in the Mississippi River. How would we address that? We've already had, there's, I think, 7 or 8 stakeholder groups. So what we're doing is also having focus groups, listening sessions, whatever you want to call them, with environmental groups, with historic preservation folks, with developers, with folks that do economic development for a living. So we're trying to reach out and try to get as much input. Again, no decisions are really made until, you know, that week in May. Ultimately, the council will look at this probably in September or October, the final document. But we're leading up to that charrette week with these introductory sessions about the site and what good design might be for the site.
So, Ed, why have a charrette process to help guide this project?
What this does is gives public input. And what it looks for is all the different ideas. And basically, the more information that you can get from all facets of the community, the better the decision is going to be made and what that use is going to end up being. As Larry mentioned, they're having these sub-meetings, and they're meeting with the economic group. You know, there are several groups that get to put in their input into it with the consultant. In turn, they get their planners together, start putting all their different ideas and bring them back to our committee now. And we also have, it's not just the Redevelopment Authority's decision. There is a committee made up of, how many were there, 30?
No, I think there's 7 on the Redevelopment Authority and I think 8 others. So we're trying to include members of the Park Commission, the Arts Board, the Board of Public Works, City Plan Commission, the Neighborhood Commission, someone from downtown Main Street. So we're calling that the Steering Committee. So essentially they'll take a lot of this input. They'll filter it, and they can make a recommendation to the redevelopment authority, even though the redevelopment authority is part of this. And ultimately, this plan gets adopted by the council and the redevelopment authority. So, you know, we'll be talking to hundreds of people over the course of the next 2 or 3 months here.
Well, I imagine just all the input, especially if you want public input, you know, you could have a person who wants solely apartments or someone who wants another music venue or something like that. But then how do you ultimately whittle it down and make that final decision through this process?
Part of it is economics. Again, one of these guiding principles is that what we're doing here has to, I guess fundamentally, I think the Redevelopment Authority's belief, like mine, is we use public dollars to acquire this property. And so the public should have every right to be part of the process, and we should go overboard in including the public. But at a certain point, there's also one of the guiding principles is tax base, is that the city needs tax base and that people need housing, people need places to shop, et cetera. And so you have to balance what would be, you know, public waterfront, trails, natural area versus some tax base to help support that. And so I think the SHRET process, as it's been described, is the highest and best use, the best idea will rise to the top, whatever that is, but it has to be feasible in the marketplace. So one of the team members as part of the SHRET team is a real estate economist. And so when we looked at all the consultants, we had 3 firms bid on this work. They all had a real estate economist component because eventually we're going to try to recruit a developer. And so the Redevelopment Authority, I think, has done a fairly successful job in revitalizing some projects downtown, like the Market Square Ramp, like the Transit Center, like everything around the Riverside Center 1, 2, and 3 buildings, and the Weber Center. And even before that was the apartments around where Century Tel is. Those are all projects of the Redevelopment Authority. So the Redevelopment Authority has its kind of fingerprint on a lot of, I think, really good development. And I think that's why people should be confident in how this goes forward, because it's essentially citizens as well that make up the Redevelopment Authority.
Ed?
That's the exact point that Larry got across, is it is about the public, and it's about getting their input. And what we really want is to get as many different ideas, and it doesn't have to come from my background specifically is construction. You know, so if I would look at things, I probably look at things on a straight line. One thing I've gotten to learn from this whole thing is looking at arts and history, and these are things that I think are going to be very, very good for this whole charrette. And I also want to believe that what we're looking at here is that this is going to be a imprint that's going to be here that I want my ancestors to be able to say they did a very good job of looking forward. And that's the bottom line, is that we look forward and make sure it's the best use.
So just to make sure I completely understand, this is city land, obviously, but then once the buildings go up, do you sell off the land to whoever develops upon them?
Some portion. Again, I think out of the 65, 70 acres, there will be roughly half of it that remains in public ownership. Again, that will be.
And that's the park area. And
that's the park. That's the waterfront. I think cities learned a long time ago, when you have an opportunity to have waterfront, you don't give it away. And that really is the public realm. But behind that, there can be tax base that supports that, that can also enjoy that. So, yes, there will be sites that hopefully will be sold off to developers as to whatever the ultimate land use gets agreed upon.
So why not have every process involve this charrette process, especially if you want to intensely get something done in a week versus 8 months?
Well, again, this is not cheap, and it's really the first time. And I don't know if folks...
It's about $200,000 for them.
Right, right. And years ago, if folks are familiar with Middleton Hills in Madison, it was a Marshall Erdman company. And so we're thinking that this might only be, you know, 1 or 2 or 5 times in Wisconsin that people have used this charrette process. It's kind of evolved over the years. There is what's called a National Charrette Institute. They do certificate training. We sent one of our staff. When we put out this request for proposals for consultant teams, that was like number one. We wanted someone who's done this before. One of the lead members is his name's Tom Lowe. He's conducted 150 of these charrettes around the country for a variety, whether it's a reuse of a property, could be a comprehensive plan, could be a downtown master plan. You can use this method of planning. It's been used, you know, a couple hundred years ago. We kind of got away from it. We got into this idea where a public meeting would be you'd walk around and look at posters, and it would be. But we like what you see more and more of is the community sitting down on a map with a piece of paper with pencils and crayons in hand and saying, here's what I like. I mean, we've done this with Lincoln Middle School for planning month 2 years in a row. We did a month-long planning exercise with middle school students, and you say, what would you like in your community? And that's really what we're saying the charrette process does. It opens up for everybody.
Do you think the process will be worth the investment in the end?
I certainly think so. It's not like I hope so. I think it will be because of the way we're approaching it. And as I've looked at other projects that these consultants, whether it was this firm or the other two firms that weren't successful, is there are some very highly successful projects that are born out of this process. Again, what I found over the years, it took us 27 months to do a comprehensive plan. It was the first plan in 40 years, and that was a huge undertaking. But I've seen where we've done neighborhood plans in 8 months. And by the time you get to the end of the process, the people aren't there anymore. They're not coming to the meetings anymore because either they like what they see or it's just too much of their time. So I think in a short window of time, we get the same amount of information. It's highly condensed, and we will keep the excitement going because it's happening in 7 days instead of, 8 or 10 months.
The other aspect on this is that I agree. It's economically, I see that it should be very positive because there's 30-plus acres of developable land. And just maybe roughly taking a look at that, I'm almost believing that there's should be well over $40 million worth of tax base that should be made from that eventually. And I think looking at that return on investment, that's long range is going to be very good for our taxpayers in the city of La Crosse. And I shouldn't even just say for the city of La Crosse. It's for the Coulee region because I look beyond what this impacts. It looks beyond the city of La Crosse. It's the whole Coulee area.
So this isn't the first time that we've heard development was coming to the former mobile oil site. Is this a done deal? Is this for sure happening?
The charrette?
The development,
the reuse of
the
site. Yeah, I mean, years ago, as the city was acquiring it, so we spent 10 years in court with ExxonMobil. We acquired the property, and then we'd have folks come to us and say, will you sell, will you sell? And there was a couple that we almost did a project with, but in hindsight, it would have been a mistake because the site wasn't ready. It would have been a piecemeal approach. And so somewhere along the line, probably 6-7 years ago, the Redevelopment Authority said, we're not going to sell off, the front 3 acres and have a car dealership there. We're going to look at this holistically and then maybe to the benefit, not to too many people the benefit there was, but in 2007 you had a major recession. And so this project and a lot of projects like the County Park Plaza property, they're just not viable in the worst recession since the Great Depression. So that allowed us to finish acquiring the property, do the environmental remediation, and now the economy is in good shape. And I think we have a process that will, result in a viable plan. That's really at the end of the day, that's what we want, is a viable plan that has community consensus.
But you're confident that the development will happen?
I am. Something will happen there.
Okay.
I think you don't have to look. You just look right across the street. There's $20 million worth of development that all happened right in 2006 and 2007. They had a heck of a time selling the condominiums off, again, during the recession. They've had some struggles with the old Standard Oil building, but that's now fully occupied. We have the county looking at Lot C. You have Hampton Inn has announced that they want to build a hotel downtown.
In the warehouses next to the fest grounds.
That all can get cleaned up.
Yeah.
And, we're looking at a 12-acre redevelopment at the old Train Plant 6 site. The county is still working on the Park Plaza site. So I think for this site, I'm hoping the stars are aligned that we can, have a good outcome.
And getting to the point where, with is the development going to happen in that? No matter what, I see something happening someday. You know, who and when, you don't know. But again, what Larry said, if you take a Kodak picture back at what the looked on the east side of Copeland Avenue and that, and what's there now, it's phenomenal. And it's the same thing in the downtown area. How I believe that we have rebuilt some of the downtown area with, I think, with better use than it was before. Not that it wasn't a very good tax base and having Cargill in that, on that site, but we ended up moving them over to town of Campbell and to a better site in the industrial area. Changed the dynamics of our downtown, which was fantastic.
Really quickly, is there a timeline for all of this?
The charrette will be the third week in May.
Okay.
And then at that point, we'll be looking at preparing a request for qualifications for developers, while at the same time we're finalizing the documents to take the final documents to the council in the September-October cycle. I also wanted to quickly say, when you look at the Transit Center, it's a $32 million project. If people recall what was there, a dirty bookstore, you know, billboards, a building without a roof. I mean, now you have a $30 million transit center that has live-work units, 90 apartments. I think that's the vision. That's a 75-year vision. That's what we're trying to get out of this process, is to folks look, as Ed said, you know, generations from now, this is a once-in-a-lifetime chance to do this project, and I think this is a good approach to move forward.
Hopefully businesses fill this one.
And hopefully businesses
will. And that one, too.
And they are.
Larry Kirch is La Crosse's city planner, and Ed Pritarski is the chair of the Redevelopment Authority. We are talking about the Riverside North Redevelopment Project, also known as the former Mobil Oil site in La Crosse. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up next, learn how neighbors are working together to fix up homes through a project known as Renew La Crosse Neighborhoods. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. This is the first week of spring, and with warmer weather comes an opportunity for homeowners to make improvements to their homes. And this is the second year La Crosse neighbors will be working together through a project called Renew La Crosse Neighborhoods. Renew stands for Revitalizing Neighborhood Empowerment with La Crosse Neighborhoods. It's a partnership of many organizations, all with an interest in improving the appearance of homes in the Powell, Pogue, Hamilton, and Washburn neighborhoods in central La Crosse. Joining Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis to talk about the improvement opportunities are Amanda Acklin. She's Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity of La Crosse, La Crosse County Planner and Renew Committee Member Charlie Handy, and Josh Hardy. He's a volunteer and Renew Committee member. Amanda Acklin was asked how Renew got its start.
Last year, I was also part of another neighborhood revitalization type initiative. I was working with Cooley Cap, and basically everybody who has an interest in the neighborhood and revitalization and all these different programs that we have here in the city of La Crosse kind of got together and said, you know, let's do something together and use the power of all of our different programs to make a difference and an impact that way. So it kind of started that way. It was going to be a two-day event, one day in the middle of May, and ended up being a month-long event and went really well. So we're going to do it again and hope it becomes a tradition.
What organizations are involved in addition to Habitat for Humanity?
Well, there's a lot. So Habitat for Humanity, Cooley Cap. There's the City of La Crosse, who also has the Paint and Fix-Up program. There's the county is also involved. Gunderson Health Systems. Mayo is going to be getting involved this year. Viterbo, the colleges, volunteers, the neighborhood associations. The list goes on. Really, we invite anybody. There's contractors and anybody who has an interest and wants to help better the community.
Why is a program like this needed in the city of La Crosse at this time?
Well, we're a great city, and you know, things don't stay perfect forever, and it takes work and love. And it takes a community to come together. So this is exactly what it is. You know, there's not just one program out there saying, I'm going to take the reins and do everything. Really, you need a collaboration and people to work together in order to make things happen. And it doesn't just focus on the houses. Really, we also focus on the community aspect and bringing people together and the neighborhoods themselves, too. So we're actually having the neighborhoods come up with projects that will better the neighborhood that we can all work together on.
Charlie, put your county planner hat on for a while. Why is a program like this needed?
Well, I think it's needed in every community. I mean, we talk about neighborhoods, but this is what creates neighborhoods. The activities that we went through last year, we just had a good time. We enjoyed it. I think the residents enjoyed it. It created a camaraderie, and we just need to do that in our communities. Sometimes people see things getting so large and impersonal, and we just got to keep it personal. That's what it's all about, is talking to each other, working with each other. This gets us a chance to get out there and get our hands dirty. Sometimes most of us sit behind a desk all day. It's a good thing to go out and get dirty.
Josh, you got involved last year as a volunteer and are a little more involved now in the program. But why did you volunteer for this?
Well, last year I had a friend invite me to the opening day with the picnic and some of the bigger projects. And then this year Amanda asked me to help out. And I have a lot of clients I work with who live in that area, and some of them don't have the ability or the financial means to fix up their homes or just make minor repairs. So it's nice to be able to help out in that way as well.
What is special about these two neighborhoods, the Paul Pogue Hamilton and Washburn neighborhoods, that they've been singled out?
Both of those neighborhoods are very low-income neighborhoods, old neighborhoods. They've been targeted by the Revitalization Initiative, and so there are a lot of different funds that are targeted at those neighborhoods. And so the programs that have those funds, you know, are able to work together. We are more than happy next year to actually start moving on to another identified low-income neighborhood up in the north side, too. So we'll be spreading the love.
Yeah, because last year, I'll let you explain, but you started in Paul Polk Hamilton and added Washburn this year, did you not?
Yes.
Yeah, you got to start somewhere.
Right.
I don't think there's any one neighborhood in La Crosse that is more or less qualified for this. We need to get out to all of them and work in them. And we need the residents to get together and act as a neighborhood. So just got to start somewhere. There was some momentum in the last year was called Powell Hood Hamilton neighborhood, now Paul Pogue. I think the larger employers will also have an effect on this. You can see that Gunderson and Mayo being involved in this program helps significantly. And so if there's other neighborhoods in the city of La Crosse that are interested, give us a call. We can certainly talk about priorities and when that should happen. But also the larger employers in those neighborhoods have an effect.
Mm-hmm. How does it work? What types of projects are you able to do?
Yeah, well,
and who pays for it?
It's a wide variety of programs. So, for instance, Cooley Cab has some AHP funds and some different grant funds that they can do. They have some funds for weatherizing homes as well. So, you know, they have those funds. We have critical home repair funds. The city has the paint and fix-up funds. So really we're saying, okay, we have all these different funds that are available. Some of them are grants. Some are low-interest loans or no-interest loans. There's a wide variety, and we're going to do what we can to make sure that the homeowners get the best of those programs and really figure out a way for all of them to work together. And we're also out there applying for grants and asking local businesses here in the community to kind of step up and help us do this.
So the potential for not paying a lot of money to have a project done at your home exists.
Yes, yeah. I mean, Habitat for Humanity, you know, did start off building homes for people who couldn't afford to build homes. But, you know, there's that reality that there are some people who have a low-income house or have a house and they're low-income and they can't afford, for whatever reason, to make the repairs. And it's the same thing with the other programs. So we're there to help do that and help, you know, do whatever we can in all those situations.
I'll start with Josh, but the other two of you can respond as well. What types of projects did you work on last year?
Last year I helped pretty much remodel a house. We scraped off all the old lead paint and repainted her house. We took off an old deck of hers and put in some concrete steps, and we kind of did the same in the front as well. We put up a fence in her backyard and did some landscaping, then did quite a bit of landscaping in some other places. So it was quite of a change, actually.
Yeah, in that same house, Cooley Cap went in and did weatherization. The Critical Home Repair also put new windows in and fixed her bathroom that was in much need of repair. So she had a lot of things that she got new gutters too, actually. Yeah.
Charlie, what kind of work did you do last year?
My focus last year was typically on landscaping. So there was two or three of us that did a lot of the jobs together and spent a little bit of time at maybe 15 different houses on one day, getting volunteers organized and putting in boulders and mulch. And one of the really nice things was we did a lot of perennial plantings. And in many of the houses, they had daylilies or hosta that were overgrown, and they said, split them, take whatever you want. We actually had more plants at the end of the day, the first day, than we started with because there were so many donations given by people that had work to do, and it was fun. Good time.
Who are the primary people who are getting the help?
It's pretty open. For a lot of the programs, there is an income stipulation, but not for all of them. The grant for the city paint fix-up doesn't matter. So can elderly, low income, really we're there to help the whole neighborhood. And if somebody wants to also get involved and come out and help us, and then we can go over to their yard and help them, really it's just all about working together and doing the community as a whole. But Charlie also did help last year, too, do the Hamilton Elementary landscaping as well. So we had some good donations and had a big group of people out front doing that and made some garden boxes too.
What kind of reaction do you get from the people you help, Josh?
Usually very positive and emotional response. A lot of times last year Renee had some tough times holding back her tears and whatnot. She was just overcome with joy a lot of the time because she had been working on that house for a long time. And I know a lot of the first things that she did, her and her husband at the time did a lot of that work. So to see it all kind of come back together and become almost a new house was really pretty powerful emotionally for her.
So how many projects did you do last year, and how does that compare to what you're planning to do this year?
Our goal last year was 20, and we set this year at 30, which is probably kind of low because we did 52 projects last year, and 52 projects, 40, it might have been 51 and 42 different properties. So there were some properties that there were multiple projects that went on different days. So I think 30 is probably kind of low, but it's higher than last year's goal. So we put in over 1,000 hours of volunteer hours last year.
Really?
Those are just the counted
ones.
And
you haven't had a problem finding volunteers? I mean, the number of projects match up pretty well with the number of volunteers.
Volunteers, especially here in La Crosse, it's pretty easy to get volunteers. I mean, you know, obviously the more projects we have, the more volunteers we're going to need. We started off the first day last year with about 45 people on the first day. The closing day we had 94 volunteers. So with the word getting out and this being the second year, I think that our opening day is probably going to look more like our closing day last year.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We are talking about the Renew program in the city of La Crosse, an effort to spruce up homes in the Washburn and Paul Polk Hamilton neighborhoods in the city of La Crosse. Our guests include Habitat for Humanity La Crosse, Executive Director Amanda Eklund, La Crosse County Planner and Renew Committee Member Charlie Handy, and Renew Committee Member and Volunteer Josh Hardy. What are you hoping to accomplish this year? How many projects and what type of projects do you already have lined up?
We're in the middle of still taking applications. So the official applications for a lot of the grant programs and the from Cooley Cap and Habitat, our applications due on March 22nd or March 21st. We are doing an application drive at the Washburn Expo on the 22nd, so we'll still take some applications. But we are hoping to do a lot more homes this time with the overall, like, big, huge changes, kind of similar to the one house we did last year. 30 projects, two large neighborhood projects. So the neighborhood associations are working with us and coming up with projects that they feel will enhance their neighborhood.
Does this cover not only exterior projects but the interior as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there'll be a little bit of both. And anywhere there's something going on, we'll have a sign out front of the house, a nice green, bright green yard sign that says Renew La Crosse Neighborhoods. So even if you don't see somebody outside working on the house, you know that there was something done, and it would have been done to, you know, weatherize or for the health and safety of the residents in the home. So
in addition to looking better and having people feel better about their properties, there are some other benefits to doing this type of thing. And maybe this is a question for Charlie. Things like higher property values, the chance that there could be a lower crime rate eventually in a neighborhood like this. Could you talk a little bit about that aspect of it?
I think any time where you have families that connect with each other in a neighborhood, whatever that family may look like, they know each other better, and that's just the heart and soul of a neighborhood. So people have more pride. That's the one thing that we really found last year was in the Paul Pogue Hamilton neighborhood. There are so many properties there already that are beautiful, that are beautifully maintained, and the landowners are so proud of what they have. They're concerned about what's happening, about the decline. And so if they start to see things turn around, if we get to that tipping point where things improve, you know, that's the goal, so that people feel comfortable investing in their property and people feel comfortable living in the space. I think that's the other reason why the large employers are involved. They want to see their employees have a nice neighborhood close to work. And so the improvements to these neighborhoods really could potentially create a great quality of life for someone live close to work. They don't have to spend so much time commuting, things like that. Those are all real positives that we think we can see through the process of these programs.
Do other projects like this or programs like this exist in other communities around the county?
Not really yet. I think they exist, you know, in vernacular stories where, you know, people just help each other out. This is more of a larger program where we try to get those people that really want to volunteer, give them an opportunity to, but also then the people in the neighborhood give them an opportunity to connect.
In addition to what he's saying, the picnics that we have on the opening and closing day is another way that we are trying to invite the residents to come in and meet the volunteers and meet each other. So it's just, again, improve the safety, but the whole community aspect of it.
Charlie, from your perspective, would you say the city of La Crosse, probably the oldest community around here with the oldest housing stock?
I would say by far the largest quantity of older housing.
Yeah.
There's older houses in all the communities, but, you know, just by sheer population and sheer size, the largest quantity. So it's also the urban core. I mean, people started in this area, you know, and the populations came here for a reason, you know, the confluence of the rivers and the transportation and et cetera. So that was some of the earliest development was in the city of La Crosse.
From a planning standpoint, what is the hope if you spruce up a neighborhood or neighborhoods like this? What does that do to the community in general in 10, 15, 20 years down the road?
Just like anything else, everything needs maintenance. Everything needs support. So I just think in general, it's a positive thing to continue to encourage people to do that, to improve and to maintain. But I think the main thing here is to show that there's a commitment. There's a commitment by, if you want to look at it, the community as a whole. There's a commitment by the neighborhood individually, and also a commitment just by the individual people.
Now, you've been signing up people since March 1st, but there's one more opportunity for people to to sign up. Could you talk about that, Amanda?
The Washburn Neighborhood Association has a garden expo that they'll be holding on the 22nd of March at the Lincoln Middle School. And we will have a booth set up there with applications and more information. And make sure that anybody who does come and applies gets in by the deadline, too.
And the work itself will be done how?
And
when? And do you have no volunteers to
well,
do it all?
Well, we have just opened up the volunteer registration. So anybody can go to renewlacrosse.org, and it's lacrosse is all spelled out, and start registering to volunteer. So we don't have a lot of volunteers yet. I'm not worried about it, though. We have a few groups that have already said they wanted to do it. So we'll actually start on May 4th, and that is a Sunday. It will continue to do work throughout the month on Saturdays, except for Memorial Weekend. And then we'll have a large closing day on June 7th. So we'll get quite a few Saturdays in there. The bulk of the volunteers will be wanting on May 4th and June 7th.
La Crosse has a number of neighborhood associations now, and some are probably better than others, but I think everybody's heart is in the right place. What is the future of the Renew program? You started in the Powell Poe Hamilton neighborhood last year, opened it up to Washburn this year. Do you keep envisioning expanding the program?
Well, we want to also make sure that we keep we don't go too big, and our focus in the particular year is not too large at one time. So we'll probably go up to the north side next year, and we probably won't be in the neighborhoods that we're in this year. Last year, we started in the Powell Polk Hamilton neighborhood, and there's a lot of work that was to be done there. And so we decided that 2 years would probably be a little bit better, but we also did want to extend and get out there to the Washburn neighborhood, who was also in need. And they have a really good neighborhood association. That's really important for us as a program to have a neighborhood association that's really involved as well. So if there's neighborhoods that really want to have Renew there, one of the first steps is to come together as a neighborhood. If you don't have an association, form an association so that we have a group of people that is – so it's not just people from outside of the neighborhood or other programs coming in. You know, we want to work with the residents.
Has the Restore, the Habitat for Humanity Restore, come in handy for this as well?
Yeah, I envision this year we might use it a little bit more. Last year, our projects kind of came in right at the last minute. We're trying to do that a little bit better this year and get an idea of what of our projects are a few weeks out so we know what we need. So most definitely, there's a ton of really great things at the Restore, and I think it will be an asset.
Is there anything that any of you three would like to add to the discussion?
I want to add that we've been meeting as a committee now for a few months. That's an impressive thing when you go into a Renew meeting and there's that many people sitting at the table. Almost every meeting we've got to pull in another table, yeah. Add a few more chairs. There's so many people that are interested, that are excited, that have energy for the program, and that are bringing really valuable assets to the table. So you can see that expanding in the future, and just that level of interest. I go to meetings every day, part of my job, and typically those meetings get to be fairly dry and long. They're necessary. But when you get to go to a meeting like this where there's energy in the room, there's excitement, there's people really have a vision to go the distance together, it's a nice thing, and that brings more people in.
Josh?
Yeah, I've just been really happy and impressed with when I talk to local business owners or just people in La Crosse about volunteering or donating some goods or services to the project. They get really excited about it, and everybody's really happy to kind of spread some love into some of these communities and help these people improve their lives.
Amanda, anything else you want to add?
I have been very impressed with the amount of people who've been coming to the table and to these meetings and the businesses that have been donating. I want as many of the people and businesses to know about it so that, you know, they can get involved. It's not too late. they can contact us, get involved by a monetary donation or in kind of donation of any sort, come to the community meetings. We would invite everybody to come and join us.
Amanda Acklin is Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity of La Crosse. Charlie Handy is La Crosse County Planner and member of the Renew Committee. And Josh Hardy is a Renew Committee member and volunteer. They've been talking with Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis about the Renew program. The Revitalizing Neighborhood Empowerment with La Crosse Neighborhoods program works to improve homes in the Powell, Polk, Hamilton, and Washburn neighborhoods. Volunteers will be working on homes in May and June. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. There, you'll also find a link to the Renew La Crosse Neighborhoods website. Our site also archives other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.